morning, everyone. I'm Dimitri Papadimitriou from the Migration Policy Institute, and I'd like to welcome you all in this terrible, rainy, not good, very bad day. We appreciate that you braved the elements to join us, and I also would like to welcome the people who are watching us, because this event is streamed. I will say a few words about our speakers, and then I will talk a little bit about what today's conversation is about, and then we're going to start the panel. I have certain rules, at least in the panels that I chair, you know, that I try not to interrupt our guests. But in return, I'm hoping that the guests, notice hoping, that the guests will be disciplined and only talk for about 12 or 14 minutes and absolutely no more. We'd like to leave about 20, 25 minutes for discussion. So let's try to all be as disciplined as we possibly can. It's a rare pleasure for me to introduce a friend from a long time, and Richard, who is the Assistant Secretary for Population, PRM, Refugees and Migration. You know that, as you know, the order of the letters changed in the mid-1990s. So,
yes. I appreciate you getting it right this morning.
And we've known each other for about 20 years. She's had a very distinguished career at the State Department, as head of resources and planning and policy in the office of the secretary, the office of the deputy secretary. She's been the number two person at the Peace Corps. She's held a number of other positions. And as of a couple of years ago, less than 2 years ago, has been assistant secretary for PRM. And welcome. I don't want to say extreme left or anything like that.
All right.
No, let's not use the word extreme altogether. On my right, on the other side of the table, is Christos Panagopoulos, the ambassador of Greece to the United States. He's been in the post a little less than 2 years. A very distinguished diplomat. He has been chef de cabinet in both to the deputy secretary and the secretary. Interesting, comparable kinds of things. A very experienced senior ambassador of the diplomatic service of Greece. And it is a privilege to welcome you here, Ambassador. And to my left is the very famous, at least to MPI audiences, Michael Fix. Until the end of last year, Michael was Senior Vice President and Director of Studies and co-director and co-founder of the Integration Center here at MPI. And as of January of this year, he has been the first ever CEO of MPI. So he no longer has to sign in two lines. He can actually sign in one line now, just CEO, and that takes care of that. But Michael has spent, you know, certainly a couple of decades thinking hard about immigrant integration. And he and Margie McHugh created the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy about 8 years ago here at MPI. Before that, he was at the Urban Institute, where he was the senior person on migration and integration studies. Our topic today, you know what the title is. I'm not going to repeat it. Let me say a few things about, you know, migration systems more generally. From the outside, somewhere in Mars, or perhaps 50 years ago, people might have thought that building and administering a migration system is essentially a fairly simple exercise in governance. You make the rules as to who comes in other words, admissions policy, how you do it. You spread the function over a number of different ministries, or in some instances, you have a single ministry that does all of the functions and represents the migration function within the cabinet. Canada does that. Australia does that. On and off, several EU member states have done that. In the United States, you know, we have part of the function, the one that deals with migration and refugees and population to a certain degree, you know, in the State Department. The actual administration of the immigration laws, including some of the issues that we'll be discussing today, you know, borders and all of the issues relating to borders are done by, you know, used to be the Justice Department. Now, of course, it's the Department of Homeland Security. And then the third element of it is what happens after people get in. In other words, okay, we've done our job well or well enough, or not so well or well enough. People have come in, and now what happens? And that's where immigrant integration comes in. In other words, the basic proposition here is that for an immigration system to succeed, and for all of us in the receiving society, but also the immigrants themselves and their families, to do well and contribute to the country of destination, you have to do well by the immigrants, and the immigrants have to do well by us in order to have a successful immigration system. And that's not nearly as easy as it seems. And sometimes, you know, I wonder whether countries like the EU, all the member states, and as of 10 days ago, you all saw that in Switzerland, people and governments are indeed very confused, trying to exercise those three fairly simple functions. And I would almost say that there is a certain degree of an indictment to, you know, that is directed to many, many, many countries that suggests that we're not doing any of the functions of immigration writ large as well as we could. Now, today we're not going to discuss the entire system. Rather, we're going to discuss a couple of elements of it. One of them, of course, is what are the challenges at the border? We all know what, you know, the enforcement challenges at the border are. But we're going to focus today on one aspect of this, which is the humanitarian challenges that we face at the border. And Anne will be talking about those. And Michael will be talking about the integration challenges, particularly focusing on language and workforce access and development. Because again, no one does that nearly as well as it needs to be done. There's some countries that do it slightly better than others. The usual suspects are indeed the ones that are doing it a little better, you know, the Canadians, the Australians. The United States, you know, has, you know, a system for doing these things that's a bit opaque because people look at the national government from the outside to do all of these integration activities. But in the United States, it's not the government that does that. It is states and localities and civil society. And this is always the most difficult thing to explain when you're talking to Europeans in particular. In other words, that indeed, the civil society is not an extension of the government. It's not the place that actually delivers programs, although it also delivers programs, but it is the place where an awful lot of ideas are generated, where advocacy takes place, and where great things happen on the ground that most people are not aware of. So there is a secret to America's success with immigration and immigrant integration, and that secret is that it engages the non-governmental sector, it puts them front and center, it knows how to work with the government, and as a result, we're doing better than it may look that we're doing from the outside. So the order will be that the ambassador will talk a little bit about the goals and priorities of the Greek presidency of the European Union. I suspect that you all know that during the first semester, the first 6 months of this year, Greece holds the rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union. And that means it is, you know, sort of like in a primus inter pares situation. And then Anne will talk to us about some of the things that we ought to be thinking hard about, the humanitarian challenges at our border, but in all borders. And Michael will bring us home by talking about how well we're doing in the United States and raise some issues about how perhaps we need to do better. Mr. Ambassador, Kyrie Presby.
Thank you. Well, should I speak in Greek? Might be a very good idea. Thank you very much. Dimitri, if I know something is that the weather is against this discussion. You may recall that it was supposed to take place last Friday, Thursday, but then the big blizzard came in, and here we are with supposedly sunny weather. Anyway, I fully appreciate your presence here because you came under difficult conditions for Washingtonians, at least. I can bring you some nice weather. Right now in Athens is around 20 degrees, not Fahrenheit Celsius. And if you cannot take the trip now, we do expect you during the summer and the spring. But anyway, it's a great pleasure for me to be with you here. And I would like to welcome also our assistant secretary who took the time to be with us. And let me give you a couple of insights how this came about. First of all, I will start with the Greek presidency. A lot of people, they come to me and they ask me, Greece, the president of the European Union with a crisis, I have to tell you that this is not an option for us. It's according to the treaties, it's a rotating presidency. Every member state has to do that, and we are determined to fulfill our obligations to set the agenda. We cannot do that all alone, as Mr. Papadimitriou said, but along with our partners, we're formulating the agenda for this current 6 months. We have a past, believe it or not, of five very successful presidencies. We are already an old member of the European Union, quite almost 35 years old member of the European Union. So in the past, we have already five chances to the presidency. I remember that all these presidencies have been marked with great crises. We didn't create them, we found them. But we went, generally speaking, well in balancing, I mean, so many different events. I remember the last president, it was the Iraq crisis. Before that, there was the war in ex-Yugoslavia. So Greece succeeded, I mean, to bring some kind of balance there. So some months ago, during the summer, I believe, I was visiting with Mr. Papadimitriou. I came to this great institute here, and I said, I have the presidency, would like to find something very creative, which cross-board, I mean, the transatlantic agenda. And, of course, migration came up as the very first option in our agenda. Why? Because it's very important for our country, my country, I mean, for the European Union, but for the United States as well. In August, I had the honor to have here my prime minister. We went, of course, to visit President Obama, and one of the topics we touched upon was the migration. And we were changing views because, as you know very well, this great country faces not similar, but a different kind, but certainly problems in this field also. But first of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Papadimitriou for being a very generous host and the Migration Policy Institute for hosting this event. As you just mentioned, Dimitri, my country assumed the presidency few months ago, during an era that Europe faces a lot of challenges. And we opted to promote during this 6 months, a very short period of time to create policies, but enough to mark the agenda, we decided to have a very concrete plan for the steps that Europe is going to take in the future. Our priorities are mostly based on four pillars. Further integration of EU Eurozone. We need that. Some of you, you heard about economic governance. I give you a very simple example, of which as Americans you're going to understand much more than anyone else. 18 members of the European Union, they have a common currency, the euro. The United States, they have a federal bank. There's no such a thing in Europe. There are lots of things to be done in order to achieve a balance if we are about to talk about common currency, common policies. So building further integration of EU Eurozone, it's one of the priorities. Then jobs, growth and cohesion. My country, because of the crisis, can very well understand all these priorities that are of absolute priority right now. Then we introduced in our dialogue with our partners maritime policies, which again, it's a subject which touches upon priorities here in the United States as a global power. And of course, last but not least, migration, borders, mobility. I feel certain that today we have the opportunity to discuss a lot of things having to do with migration, mobility, and certainly we provide the opportunity for a frank, productive discussion on an issue that really affects the lives and welfare of all of us, as individuals and as states on both sides of the Atlantic. Why? Because migration is a global phenomenon. And throughout the years, migration has played a significant role in shaping the world as we know it today. Now, particularly in Europe, it has become more and more evident that instability in its periphery, together with the fact that causes that lead to migratory flows into Europe have remained intact. Namely, I'd like to mention from Africa and Asia, well, all these things, they place an extra burden on EU member states in a period of economic crisis when all forces and efforts are focused on reforms aiming at safeguarding stability and revitalizing growth. Those things, they are not going together. This burden falls mainly on the EU member states that are situated at Europe's external borders, including my country, as well as on those heavily affected by recession and unemployment. In this context, the Hellenic Presidency of the European Council will concentrate its efforts as highlighting the positive aspects of a comprehensive migration management to the benefit of growth. I will spare no efforts in promoting all dimensions of migration and mobility policies. At the same time, action is envisaged to tackle the problems arising from illegal migration in economy, social cohesion, and political stability. More specifically, since its launch in 2005, the global approach constitutes the main framework for EU policy and action in the area of external relations, in the field of migration and asylum. The renewed global approach on migration and mobility focuses on four operational priorities: better organizing legal migration and fostering well-managed mobility, second, preventing and combating illegal migration and eradicating trafficking in human beings, third, maximizing the development impact of migration and mobility, fourth, promoting international protection and enhancing the external dimension of asylum. Now, developing an area of freedom, security, and justice has been and will continue to be a major objective for the European Union. In addition, today that Europe is facing multifaceted challenges, unfortunately, probably it faces the most formidable crisis in its history, It has become more than necessary to reinforce the common European policy on the areas of justice and home affairs. Such a common policy must be founded on genuine solidarity, joint responsibility, and joint cooperation. Are we there yet? Not, but we're working on this. Europe, as one of the most important geopolitical poles in the world, is projecting the image of an open Europe. An open Europe which promotes legal immigration channel for increased mobility and growth. A Europe which protects the lives of third country nationals when threatened and offers sanctuary to those people in need of international protection. A Europe cooperating with third countries for the benefit of regional development and therefore ultimately the prevention of illegal immigration. Now, migration and development are closely interlinked, we think. The challenges of the development aspect of migration are numerous, and the task of to address them successfully is very, very difficult. And we know that from our own experience. Both host countries and countries of origin must deal with issues such as brain drain, protection of migrants' rights, minority integration, religion, citizenship, xenophobia, human smuggling and trafficking, and national security. Mr. Papadimitriou just described and touched upon all these issues in a very, very successful way. But it's also a fact that migration, when managed effectively, can have a substantial positive impact both for the country of destination and for the country of origin. We can maximize the beneficial effects of international migration on development and minimize the negative ones through international cooperation and coordination of our policies. Cooperation in this area is of utmost importance, not only between governments, but also with non-governmental actors such as civil society, the private sector, and international organizations. Dear friends, it is more than evident that migration and its consequences constitute one of the most challenging issues of modern societies. Migration is a cross-cutting phenomenon that should be addressed in a coherent, comprehensive, and balanced manner, integrating development with due regard to social and economic dimensions. Given the perplexity of migratory flows, there is a need for a better understanding of migration as multidimensional pattern, while it is important at the same time to continue to partner more effectively with all stakeholders involved in migration and development on a regional and global level. In this vein, does the United States and the European Union share the same concerns when it comes to migration and integration issues, it is clear that we should continue the transatlantic dialogue on the issue. A closer dialogue on migration on both sides of the Atlantic offers the opportunity for better understanding, shared expertise, and best practices. It also advances even further our cooperation and forges our alliance in an era when we face new political, social, as well as economic challenges. And this cooperation is going on. I'm very happy that MPI is a very active partner. Mr. Papadimitriou and his colleagues, they do participate on this ongoing dialogue, and indeed we are looking forward to the remarks of Assistant Secretary. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. I don't know how we do that, but thank you very much for your remarks, Mr. Ambassador. Kyria Presidente, ευχαριστούμε πάρα πολύ για αυτά. I want to touch on four points because we're going to get back to those points again and again. The ambassador spoke of solidarity and cooperation as key goals of Europe on this issue. We also know that on this particular issue, one can argue, and one would not be wrong, that we don't have much solidarity or cooperation. And that is a simple fact of life. I am pleased that, Mr. Ambassador, you talked about the positive elements of migration. Migration is one of those things, one of these processes that can add value to everyone that engages that process. But in order for that value to be evident to the public, we must do something about the adverse effects of immigration. And we also know that there are things that are not positive about migration, the way that migration happens today. So we all need to put our head together and do better in terms of controlling and minimizing the costs of migration, again, for all concerned. The third one, the third point that I want to take out of your comments is that the migration system is a global system. You know, 20 years ago, you could say, there are 30 or 40 players. They account for 80, 90, 95% of all global flows. So it's an affair for a quarter or so of all of the countries of Earth. Now you have about 230, 240 million people who meet a fairly strict definition by the United Nations, which probably suggests that there's probably an unknown number of additional people who haven't met the one-year requirement. This way they can be counted in the UN system, or who are in a status that is an uncounted status. So maybe the number is 250, maybe the number is 300. You know, we can speculate about these things all evening, all day. And, you know, even if you looked at the headlines, you know, a few days ago, in the argument between, you know, China or the human rights report about China returning North Koreans back to North Korea, that gives you a sense that even a closed place like North Korea engages the migration system. Not frontally, not as a matter of government policy, but it participates in it. So I can't think of a single country that is not a player in immigration today. And the final point, and something that, you know, Anne and most of you, I guess, are well aware of, is that there is a dictum there that we're all trying to figure out, you know, how to do, how to get to that point. Better cooperation on how we do migration can bring better results for everyone. So these are the things that I thought that I would emphasize from your presentation, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you very much, Dimitri, for such a warm welcome here at MPI. And it is true that 20 years ago, Dimitri was a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment thinking about starting something like MPI. And I was supposed to be someone with potential in the future of my career. And so before we get too carried away, you know, just sort of reveling in how far we've come, I'd just like to point out that Samantha Power was the intern, and she's now a member of the president's cabinet. So maybe if we'd worked a little harder, Dimitri, we'd be even more august than we are today. But I hope that those of you in the audience who are interns will feel very good by this story, and I'll be accepting your cards later on. So without further ado, let me jump into my remarks because I'd like to cover quite a few things. Migration poses complex policy challenges. There are no easy answers, as you've probably already gathered from what the ambassador has said. Throughout history, the movement of people has contributed to the economic development and establishment of countries like my own, our own, the United States. In this day and age, migration can also be fraught with dangers and uncertainty for millions of migrants who fall victim to smugglers and traffickers. And it is important that governments minimize the negative aspects of migration by establishing safe, orderly, and legal migration processes in order to prevent abuse. But at the same time, as Dimitri was saying, there are positive aspects. So governments need to maximize the economic, social, and cultural benefits of migration. Migration is an inevitable, very human phenomenon that must be dealt with on a continuing basis. It is not an issue that can be put off until policymakers have more time to focus on it or economic conditions improve. And one of the main messages I want to share with you today is that the U.S. faces many of the same challenges as the European Union. And I think that will become evident in our discussion today. It's difficult for any country to maintain the integrity of national migration protection and border systems in the face of increasing irregular and mixed migration flows. especially in a maritime environment. And we've seen this in past crises. In the United States, we look at the Caribbean, we see Cubans and Haitians coming by sea, a very dangerous voyage. We've seen in the past boat departures in Asia from Vietnam. And of course, currently there are these migratory routes in which migrants and refugees cross the Gulf of Aden and the Mediterranean, fleeing poverty and persecution. We are in recent months seeing a similar pattern emerging from the Syrian crisis, and I spend a great deal of time lately on the Syrian crisis, but it's not just a refugee crisis, it becomes a migration crisis when growing numbers of Syrians and Palestinians who are fleeing Syria arrive in Europe by both land and sea and seek asylum. So in my remarks, I would like to talk about 5 points. The first is the benefits of having regional and multilateral approaches. The second is the benefits of having holistic approaches. Points 3 and 4 are about some of the specific issues with which we're wrestling right now. One is the phenomenon of children setting out by themselves, unaccompanied minors, which is happening in more than one place in the world today. And then the other point is on resettlement of refugees, which you'll be able to tell is something that we spend a lot of time on in our bureau and that we see as an American success story. And then fifth, to talk a little bit about migration as a hugely emotional and, as the ambassador said, a cross-cutting issue before making some concluding remarks. So responding to migration requires regional and multilateral cooperation, not only in matters of security, but also identification and protection of vulnerable migrants and asylum seekers. We recognize the EU faces a unique challenge. You know, the migrants who are heading to Europe are fleeing often poverty, and they're crossing countries where there is a great deal of instability and lack of security, including some of the countries that are have been experienced upheaval from the Arab Spring, from upheaval in the neighborhood, critical short and medium term governance crises and security challenges. And we know the EU is working to address these issues in the region. And the US is also very interested in engaging with the EU on this. We consult regularly in different multilateral and bilateral meetings with the EU and member states to exchange best practices and discuss challenges and possible solutions. Two examples in which PRM staff participate. The first is the Intergovernmental Consultations on Migration and Asylum, or IGC. It provides a forum for an ongoing exchange of views between 17 like-minded participating countries, and observers include the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, the International Organization for Migration, or IOM, and I see Luca is here from IOM, and the European Commission. It has proven invaluable because it is so informal and candid. In fact, its best feature is not its regular meetings, but rather that our closest allies can quickly convene on an ad hoc basis to discuss immediate issues of concern, such as the Danish-led workshop on Syria and the Australia-US-led workshop on international migration governance last year. The US and EU also established, this is my second example, the Platform for Cooperation on Migration and Refugee Issues in 2009, through which we exchange views and best practices and look for joint responses in areas where we are both affected. The platform addresses migration flows, border management, return issues, asylum policy, and refugee issues, including resettlement and integration, and the links between migration and development. And so these are some very specific opportunities for transatlantic dialogue. The second point was that governments must take a holistic approach to migration policy. Protecting borders and saving lives are two sides of the same coin. They should not be viewed as policy objectives that can be traded off one against the other. Our shared values and our international obligations demand that we incorporate protection mechanisms into our border management systems and continue to address the basic needs of asylum seekers and refugees. And Syria is the latest and most pressing example of the need to be both vigilant on the security front and responsive on the humanitarian front. And I found myself on Capitol Hill in testimony trying to make sure that members of Congress do not conflate terrorists with refugees. And I think it's easier when you meet the refugees because, you know, meeting children and grandparents and families who have suffered so much makes it quite clear. But from this distance, you know, we are very concerned about some of the security threats, the evildoers running amok in that region. A holistic approach requires recognizing that asylum policy is linked to broader migration policy. For example, where countries lack sufficient avenues for legal migration, increased pressure can result on asylum systems because the latter becomes one of the few available channels for regular migration. The integrity of a country's asylum system also depends on having an effective system for returning people who do not have international protection concerns. If a country is unable to remove those who have not been able to establish a credible claim for asylum, then it undermines public confidence in and support for protecting those with a genuine need. My third point was that we need more creative, effective ways to handle unaccompanied minors. Unaccompanied minors are particularly vulnerable to abuse and exploitation. They are more likely to be targets of labor exploitation as well as sex trafficking and other forms of what we call gender-based violence. Part of my job is to advocate for the protection of refugee and migrant children. In our bureau, we advocate for and work with partners to develop new guidelines and tools to help children affected by emergencies around the world. We also fund child-focused programs like youth centers, child-friendly spaces, education programs, and our humanitarian response. And we are also seeking policy solutions and developing practical programs to address the results of dangerous migration of unaccompanied minors around the world. I recently went on a trip to Ethiopia, and I saw firsthand Eritrean children who had fled Eritrea, and it wasn't clear to me whether this was with the blessing of their parents or not, but they got to safety in Ethiopia, but it was very apparent, it was sort of an open secret, that they were not intending to stay in refugee camps in Ethiopia, that they saw these as sort of a transit point along a journey that they intended to take to get to either South Africa or to Europe. And we talked to them about the dangers of the trek that they wanted to set out on. And they kind of knew the dangers, but they had that feeling of really having no other recourse, no other avenue for their future unless they set out and undertook this dangerous journey. Similarly, I've met recently with several groups that are concerned about unaccompanied children showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border. A phenomenon where parents, again, are sending their children north, hoping for a better life, but knowing full well that bad things could happen to them on the route. So these are the stuff that make any parent have nightmares, thinking about these kids heading off. And so this is something that we are working on at PRM. My fourth point was that resettlement is a critical element of a policy. Many European commentators, I'm sorry to say, resist the idea of EU states accepting more refugees for resettlement, claiming that Europe instead receives more asylum seekers. But we think this is a false dichotomy. Resettlement and asylum should not be seen as a policy trade-off. They address different needs. In particular, a robust resettlement program provides solidarity and support to the countries on the front lines of refugee crises. Countries urged by the international community, and people like me, to keep their borders open to those fleeing violence and persecution. So I think it's a very important demonstration of goodwill and ability to share some of the strain by bringing refugees to the United States. According to UNHCR, the U.S. was the largest recipient of new asylum claims in 2012 with over 70,000, accounting for 8% of all individual applications worldwide. And this is separate from an additional two the nearly 70,000 refugees that we endeavor to resettle from third countries each year. My fifth point was that migration is a highly emotive, cross-cutting issue that touches on deeply personal notions of identity, community, and common humanity. So it's therefore very important that we speak openly about migration and asylum with citizens. There is no doubt that these policies and programs have an impact on domestic politics. But policy dialogue should include clear and honest discussion on the challenges and benefits of migration. In the United States, we can gain public support by putting an individual face on the migrant or the asylum seeker. Our resettlement programs can help the general public understand these policies. We have resettled refugees in nearly every one of the 50 states, which means people across the country have the opportunity to come into contact with those who have fled persecution and can tell their own stories. And they can tell them better than I can. And they can learn from refugee stories and feel proud that our country is providing a safe haven to those in need and helping them start a new life. But our resettlement program necessitates a lot of cooperation. It requires constant consultations and discussions between the federal government, United States states, local authorities, partner voluntary organizations, non-governmental organizations, charities, and the general public. These policies are more difficult in austere times, but no less important. And our refugee resettlement program strongly encourages refugees to become U.S. citizens as soon as they can and emphasizes early economic self-sufficiency. And like I say, it's a public-private partnership that we find works very well. Over and over again, we see success. It is a program that works. And refugees, we have to remind ourselves, are survivors. They bring a lot of talent and drive. They become productive members of society. They and their children become part of our long history of immigrants helping to build a stronger, more vibrant United States. Okay, so that's not so radical to say that Immigration Policy Institute, but I try to say that everywhere I go, including Capitol Hill. As we continue to seek avenues for positive engagement on migration issues, we have come to view the Global Forum on Migration Development as a key resource, as a platform for states, developed and developing alike, to delve into important issues of international migration. GFMD is moving closer to its goal of highlighting practical approaches to the many challenges of managing migration. The Swedish chair this year has done a brilliant job in this respect. We're looking forward to continued collaboration with the EU and others in this forum as we gear up for the summit that will take place in Stockholm in May. During the recently concluded UN high-level dialogue on migration and development, I announced that the United States would help lead an initiative on migrants in countries in crisis. This sprung out of the situation in Libya, where a lot of people being helped to flee from Libya at the time were not Libyans, but were instead third country nationals, and who had been working there. But also, if we look at Hurricane Sandy in the United States, the ongoing crisis right now in the Central African Republic, and similar conflicts or environmental disasters, you can see areas where large numbers of migrants become stranded. And what we'd like to do is see if we can agree on a set of guidelines or best practices that stakeholders can follow to better assist migrants in these kinds of situations. And so I'm very grateful that the European Commission and four additional governments, Australia, Bangladesh, Costa Rica, and Ethiopia, in addition to the International Organization for Migration and UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, and the Secretary General's Special Advisor on International Migration, Peter Sutherland, and Dr. Susan Martin from Georgetown University have joined a working group that will roll up its sleeves and do the planning to move this initiative forward. I've raced through quite a lot of material, but I took to heart what Dimitri said about let's get these statements said and then let's get into the discussion. So I am trying to be well behaved today.
You're being particularly well-behaved, which really troubles me.
Exceptionally, yeah.
I agree fully with everything you said, but what's this migration been an emotional issue? Thank you very much. And I think that two of the things that we heard, we need to take with us, you know, after this event is over. The protecting borders and protection, you know, in other words, discharging our responsibilities, both legal and humanitarian at the border, are two sides of the same coin. We use that expression primarily between migration, immigration, and integration in this place, but I think this is, you know, an extremely accurate and wonderful way to discuss this. And the second, that resettlement and asylum are complementary. You know, this is a an issue that we first put on the European agenda during the presidency of the Dutch presidency of the European Union in 2004. In fact, that was also the time that we also put on the agenda the issue of Frontex and the integration principles that came off of the Greek presidency in Thessaloniki, the conclusions, and the Dutch decided to pick it up and develop. you know, the integration agenda, the basic principles of integration. So my colleagues always tell me not to shy away from, you know, showing the transatlantic dimension of our work. So I think I've done my duties toward my colleagues. I also want to say something about children and accompanied minors and the exploitation, the challenges. You only have to go to detention centers or whatever we call these facilities in many parts of the world, you know, to see some of the appalling conditions, you know, under which these children are held. And here's an extraordinary dilemma. We all know that this is the point of the arrow for migration. Parents are apparently willing to take all the chances that you're talking mm-hmm. about in order to either reunify with their children or to create a new place, a new opportunity for them to follow their children at some time in the future. That does not take anything away from the fact that this is going to be a bigger issue. It's going to be a real crisis in terms of our humanitarian responsibilities. And if you look at the rate at which unaccompanied minors have been increasing in the United States, double in each of the last 2 years, and in Europe, you get a sense of how big that issue is going to become in the next 3 to 5 years, if not this year already. So this is something that we really need to pay attention. Thank God it's in your portfolio and in your hands. What? Good thing. Yeah.
February 27th.
I'm you see over here, you know, advertise the event on the 27th. So I'm doing my homework. So on the 27th of February, there will be an event here in this room called The Treacherous Journey: Child Migrants Navigating the U.S. Immigration System, a discussion of a new report being issued by Kids in Need of Defense, also known as KIND, and the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings. So we'd love to see you at this event. I think that's only next week, right? All right. So I've done that part too. Michael, talk to us about how we're doing with refugees. I'm sorry, with migrants, I guess, refugees too, but how are we doing in terms of helping them establish themselves and succeed in the United States?
Well, thanks, Dimitri. I will do my best with that reasonably difficult charge, and I'll just make two apologies. First, these comments are going to be, unlike the comments of the ambassador and the assistant secretary, will be rather provincial and U.S.-centric. And second, I deeply apologize for the fact that I'm going to subject you to some PowerPoint soon. So prepare yourselves. And I would say that in terms of how we're doing, Dimitri, I would say that overall, while it's generally contested, that I think really one of the U.S. success stories is immigrant integration. And it strikes me that this is in some contrast to a lot of countries where the integration enterprise is seen as pretty much of an abject failure. And what I would also contend this morning is to talk about the success of immigrants in the United States is we're really talking, the real metric of success is the success of the children of immigrants, of the second generation, to a greater extent than we're talking about the success of the first generation. My second point I like about this success of immigrants coming into the country is that this success story has come about in the face of some pretty remarkable numbers. Dimitri mentioned the UN numbers on immigrants living outside their country. Well, the United States has about 5% of the world's population living within its borders, but it accounts for about 20% of all immigrants who are living outside their borders. No other country comes anywhere close in terms of the number and share of immigrants, in terms of the number, not the share, number of immigrants within their country. That said, though, I would argue that immigrant integration remains, as it's been since I first started to get involved in it, something of an afterthought in American public policy. And here I would only point you to what was undoubtedly the high water mark of legislative progressivism when it comes to immigration reform, which was the Senate bill that was, you know, passed by the Senate in the spring, if any of you remember it. But it was notable to me and to my eyes more for its exclusion of immigrant integration than its inclusion of immigrant integration. Legalizing immigrants, should they ever legalize, were going to be barred from universal health care, and there wasn't word one in the bill about aid to state and local governments to help them settle immigrants, as there had been in 1986, the last time we had a major comprehensive immigration reform. All right, beware. So let me say a couple words about the demographics and put this in this international context. And as this pie chart shows, the U.S.'s 41 million plus immigrants are, you can see at a glance, more or less evenly divided between naturalized citizens in bluish, legal permanent resident green card immigrants in purplish, and the unauthorized in reddish, and with a small temporary immigrant population, with refugees spread between the different groups and not broken out within this chart. We can do that later. But what it makes plain, when we talk about how integration is doing, it makes plain the big immigrant integration challenge that the nation faces, which is, you know, the high level of irregularity or unauthorized or illegality within the country. What it doesn't make clear, and to me is more interesting, is the extraordinary number and complexity of mixed status families to which sustained illegality gives rise. And so while the received wisdom is that immigrants who are undocumented, immigrants who are legal immigrants, immigrants who are naturalized citizens are essentially three separate species, in fact, they are highly intertwined. In fact, they are in many ways points on a continuum. And so if we look at some of the numbers, if you look at the new immigrant survey, what it says that 40% of green card immigrants had at some point in their career in the United States been unauthorized. What you see is that over 80%, or 4.5 million, of children of the undocumented are themselves U.S. citizens. What we're finding in some work that we're doing now with Penn State University and Temple University, which is, I have to say, not quite ready for prime time, but what we're finding clearly is that a substantial share of married undocumented adults are married to legal immigrant or citizen spouses. And of course, I think it's rather broadly well known that almost half of the unauthorized have been in the United States for 10 years or more. And these are, of course, ties that bind, even in a recession. And here, I think if I could go back to the integration question and the impact of illegality, I would cite work that we've just published by the dean of the Harvard School of Education, Hiro Yoshikawa, that shows that young children in families with undocumented parents have lower early cognitive skills, and young adults with undocumented mothers have substantially lower levels of schooling than those who have mothers who are legally present. So in effect, there's a child development logic underneath immigration reform. Okay, so let me turn to a couple of different areas, important integration areas of integration policy, and I'll start with education. And focus on elementary and secondary, but mostly secondary schools. And here what you have to know is that about 1 in 10 students in U.S. school systems, elementary and secondary schools, is an English language learner, limited English proficient, doesn't speak English well. And that's a share that has pretty much remained constant over recent years. But this scale is a challenge to educators, but there's a further challenge that's embedded in this chart. As the bars on the left show, according to the 2011 census, over 80% of elementary school students who are English language learners were born in the United States. This is not too worrying. This makes a certain amount of sense. What's much more worrying here is the bars on the right, which shows that 55% of secondary school students in the United States who are English language learners, our second generation children who were born in the United States, and these have, we refer to as long-term English language learners, were educated in U.S. schools, presumably not particularly well served in them, and they were educated at a time of standards-based accountability, which singled them out for special classes and treatment and testing. So these are also, I have to say, a population that is likely to drop out. And if they do manage to make it through schools, they do manage to make it to college, these are the students who end up in remedial education or developmental education and then drop out. An important population. Let me move up the age spectrum and turn to post-secondary education. And by this, I mean enrolling in 2 or 4 year colleges. And here, what I'm going to present to you is what I think is a very pretty good news integration story. If you look at the, when it comes to graduating from high school and going to college, what we've found, and I mentioned this earlier, is really remarkable intergenerational progress from the first to the 1.5 to the second generation. In fact, look at the two bars in the middle, the green bar and the yellow bar, and what they tell us is striking, I think, and that's that second generation, mostly Mexican, Latina women are going to college at the same rate as third plus generation white women. That is one of our most disadvantaged groups and one of our absolutely most advantaged groups. But as the same green and yellow bars here indicate, while the second generation may be going to college at the same rate as white women, they're not completing college at anywhere near the same rate, 31% versus 51%. So their prospects, while they're good, are still, if you will, and this was the title of the report that we used, up for grabs. Let me turn next to the labor market, which is, of course, the principal engine of immigrant integration in the United States, where, unlike some countries in Europe and around the world, immigrants tend to be, are overrepresented in our labor market, so that we see that in 2012, immigrants were 13% of U.S. residents, but they were 17% of workers. They were over half of low-skilled workers. They were 16% of our high-skilled workers, and they were 13%, and this surprised us, they were 13% of middle-skilled workers. People don't think of immigrants being middle-skilled workers in the United States, but here they are, a proportional share. They're 13% of the population, and they're 13% of middle-skilled workers. In fact, what we found from 1990 to 2010 was that the fastest proportional growth was in this middle-skilled work, which again is kind of a testament to integration. We don't have a lot of visas set aside for middle-skilled workers. But this brings up two challenges, and I'll be brisk here. The first is the challenge of language. If you look at the bars just to the left, on the right on this screen, what you see is that fully half of full-time immigrant workers in the United States are limited English proficient. Perhaps even more tellingly, if you look at the orange bar to the bottom, what you see is that over a quarter were, low LEP. That is to say, they spoke little or no English. And I think this sheds some light on the findings of the PIAC, which is the Assessment of Adult Skills, that's done by the OECD, that found that half of U.S. residents with the lowest literacy levels were Hispanic. And it also found that there was no statistical difference in the low literacy levels of recent immigrants and immigrants who'd been in the United States for 5 years or more, suggesting that integration is proceeding rather slowly. We are now looking at those numbers and studying those numbers, and we are going to report back whether those really quite hold up. So let me conclude then with this chart, because the challenge of integration, of course, isn't limited to immigrants with low levels of skills. According to some work that we have done here at the Migration Policy Institute and that we've continued to replicate through the years, what we find is that 35% of Latin American immigrants and 27% of African immigrants with 4-year college degrees that they earned outside the United States were working in unskilled jobs. So, and then to contextualize this again, what PIAAC tells us is that the U.S. is far from being alone here, as highly educated immigrants are overrepresented among the unqualified, underemployed workers in every single OECD country. That said, these seem to me to present, and I said this before, in some ways, the world policy world. Sending country, brainwashing country, and they reflect the truism that I have taken many times from Dimitri Papadimitriou, that migration can be, if not handled correctly, a great waster of human capital. Waste that can be overcome with a number of things, language acquisition policies, smart credential recognition policies, and what we've argued hard here is for more effective integration governance that coordinates the immigration function and the integration function and that works cross-government as integration occurs cross-government. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And I don't know whether to pick up the bluish, purplish, and reddish thing. I apologize. Or
those were carefully chosen colors.
I know. So we have to have graphs now that are red and blue and purple. Mixed status families complicates things enormously. It's one of the challenges that we need to confront as we're thinking and hopefully moving toward immigration reform in this country. But there is little doubt about that. The challenge of not speaking English well, that the majority of English language learners are second generation rather than first generation immigrants. In other words, other than what it is that one would think. And this is something that we have been looking at for, probably a couple of decades. So this is not new. And the fact that we all need, going back to what Anne said and the ambassador said, Christo said, that we need to really work much harder to draw out the benefits from immigration. In order to do that, you have to make some investments. Sometimes the investments will be political in nature. Sometimes the investments will be in terms of developing new systems that will be able to integrate people. Sometimes the investments need to be not national, but international in terms of trying to recognize, to find a way to recognize the qualifications that people bring to our countries. There used to be an advertisement, I think, on television saying a brain is a terrible thing to waste. What immigrants bring with them, which is a combination of formal skills and tacit skills and experiences, if we're really going to be honest about saying that immigration can be a terrific benefit for everyone, if we do it right, one of the things that we need to do is to find a way to recognize and add value to what skills people bring with them. This happens often in the refugee system, but it happens across the migration continuum. So that's all, I have to say. But also, I will advertise, there may be some publications outside of this room, and I will give them to our guests, that address precisely what it is that you were saying, Anne, about, all of these, we call them bad actors, all of those people, the traffic people, et cetera, et cetera. It's a critical piece of the puzzle of how to do better on immigration. And we published, I think, a week or so ago, the conclusions of a Transatlantic Council meeting on precisely that topic. I will now open the floor to comments and questions. Please wait, raise your hand, wait for a microphone to reach you. It will appear out of nowhere. No. Lisa will bring it to you. And give us your name and ask your question, please. The gentleman over there I saw first.
Thank you. Daniele Moro, Johns Hopkins. Says, the question is for the Greek ambassador. This morning in Ukraine, people are still dying because they want to join Europe. In 3 months, we will have the European elections with at least 25% of the European citizens against Europe. What will be the Greek answer to this strange, apparently, situation where we are inside and we are not happy? People are dying to join us. What's wrong about Europe?
The three? Sir?
And Luca Dallo, International Organization for Migration. I was very pleased to hear the comments from Madam Assistant Secretary on the issue of migrants caught in crisis, in countries in crisis. In these days in the Central African Republic, we are really witnessing a crisis with major humanitarian implications. Tens of thousands of so-called third country nationals are stranded. Today I was reading news at the airport in Bangui. Thousands of people have been harassed where they're trying to leave on convoys. And most of these migrants are from the region. That's why there is not the level of international response that we have seen in Libya when European countries and others intervene to provide protection measures, including safe evacuation. This is not happening in the Central African Republic because most of the nationalities are from within sub-Saharan Africa. So the need to set up a mechanism, a platform, to engage countries, discuss this, and come up with practical solutions to this kind of instances is a very much an urgent issue. So very much welcome the initiative taken by the U.S. government to follow up on some of the debate at the high-level dialogue earlier this year to push this issue further. And I hope that crises such as the one that we are witnessing now in CAR will add momentum to this. And thank you.
All right. Okay. We'll take a third question and then we'll have some answers.
Hello, my name is Anjali Fleury. I work with NOMAD at the World Bank on migration issues. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems that a lot of recommendations in various literature and we've spoken about today highlight the need for governments to help protect immigrants, to maybe liberalize borders in some sense, and then also for integration measures to avoid things like xenophobia. There's a lot of recommendations, but I'm wondering if there are examples that you can direct us to, aside from maybe the United States, that show the positive impact that governments have had once they have followed through with these recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you for the easy questions. Nobody gets a buy. Nobody gets a free anything here. But if I could contextualize the first question, Mr. Ambassador, this way. You know, do you want to answer directly, or do you want to create some?
Let me say a couple of words when it comes, if I understood the gentleman well, about the European integration. It's a huge issue. I have to point out, first of all, that Europe is not going through its most happy time in its history. It's a lot of strain, a lot of Euroscepticism, if I may use this word. When it comes to my country, which happens to have the presidency right now, as I told you before, we are a declared, well-tested policy for European integration. We're not alone there. I can go back to 2003 during our Thessaloniki summit presidency, where we led them in the foundation of new policies, series of policies, to help our partners and neighbors to come closer to Europe. Despite the fact that European integration is not mentioned in the very four first priorities because of other reasons, that doesn't mean that we don't work. As a matter of fact, as we speak, the Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Greece, Mr. Venizelos, embarked on a visit almost all of the Balkan states. And open his agenda is the European integration. So it's a collective issue right now for so many different reasons. The agenda is overloaded. Some of, let's say, bigger players in the European Union, they have their own approach to the problem. But this is not going to go away. We are declared for the integration of the whole of Europe. And of course, Southeastern Europe is in the very heart of the European Union. How long it's going to take, we don't know. But it takes efforts from both sides, both those they are in, as you pointed out, but also those they demand to get in to do their due.
Thank you, Krista.
Yeah,
the crisis.
Central African Republic, it's a crisis that has many dimensions. And of course, my bureau is focused on the humanitarian dimensions of the crisis as people are fleeing the country or displaced within the country as the conflict takes on a religious nature, sectarian nature, where Christians and Muslims have been fighting each other. The Muslims make up 15 to 20% of the country, and the number of attacks against Muslims has gone down, but it partly may be because they have fled to trying to find safer places in the north of the country or outside the country. And so refugees are flooding into neighboring countries, and so we need to provide aid on a regional basis as we do. But it's also a peacekeeping dilemma because there's MISCA coming in, which is an AU force. There's talk of having them supplemented and supported by the French, but also by a European Union force. And it's also then a law and order issue because peacekeepers are supposed to keep combatants from each other. In this case, we're seeing horrible things perpetrated by neighbor upon neighbor. And that's really more of a police issue. So that suggests that perhaps a different type of force needs to be constituted and put together. And within all this then, the piece that Luca Dall'Oglio and I are both intrigued by is, can we do a better job helping people who are not citizens of the Central African Republic, but instead are there working and are from other countries? His thesis is that it may have not have gotten the attention for these folks because they are from that region. They're from largely from sub-Saharan Africa nearby. You know, we are confronting this dilemma where we'd like to put together a beautiful proposal for a new way of doing things. And meanwhile, the real world, in a very messy way, intrudes upon our work and in our elegant theoretical solutions with a very difficult real-life example of something going on at the same time that there's crisis in South Sudan, at the same time that there's crisis in Syria and its neighborhood. So it's the need, clearly, for a set of guidelines to help migrants who find themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, what might have been the right place once upon a time, but now at the wrong time, is quite pressing, I think, which is why I'm glad other countries have put the step forward to help us on this. I think we should turn to Dimitri to talk about the examples of other countries. But, I mean, I do know from my time spent residing in Europe a few times, you know, that clearly, Europe has a demographic problem in trying to have enough workers to support its aging population. So I've got to believe there are examples where that alone is a benefit to those countries. What would you say, Dimitri?
Well, certainly, the demographic situation in Europe, which is not just an issue of aging, the more important part, because you can actually do an awful lot of things with people who somehow, for the convenience of demographers, you know, we pretend that they simply are going to disappear. You know, they're going to retire at the age of 62, 63, 64, and then just live well for the next 30 years. All of these adjustments will have to be made. Some countries have already done so, and they will do more. And some are refusing to, and some are even going the opposite direction, which is, you know, absolutely the height of irresponsibility in that regard. But that's going to be solved. What cannot be solved is that the new worker pipeline is getting shorter or, you know, thinner and thinner. In other words, you cannot just have, even if you add 3 or 4 years, in actual working years, at the end of the working life, you still are going to need new workers. And that is essentially, you know, what Europe has to contend with. Interestingly enough, without really having to do so in the United States, it's a similar argument that we're having, or a similar kind of calculus that we have in the United States. So there is no doubt that there will be more immigration in Europe. The question is, considering how poorly Europe has done, the perception of the public of how poorly Europe has done in terms of selecting people. You really can't run a country, let alone a block of 28 countries, where the majority of the people that come to you select you rather than you selecting them. So you're going to have to do much more selection of immigrants. You're going to have to develop a, let's say, a full-throated immigration system that deals with all of the components of an immigration system. Europe is not there. As Europe, and for the vast majority of member states, as member states. Can't escape this, but as was already suggested, the politics are so difficult. Gentleman over there suggested that maybe 25% of the people who will be elected to the parliament on, in May of this year, starting June of this year, may be people who are skeptics, as the ambassador said. I know that newspapers will say they're anti-immigration. Newspapers love to think that this is all about anti-immigration, and they always love to cross the line and say that they're anti-immigrant. Okay, that's fine. Europe doesn't use words as carefully as we do. In Europe, you call people racists, xenophobes, etc., as if words don't have meaning. Here, we're much more, not polite, careful not to paint people who are skeptical about a certain issue or concerned that the government is not managing the issue effectively enough, we don't call them those names. They may be opposed to, you know, large scale or, you know, immigration of the one kind or the other, but we're not trying to sort of paint everyone with a single color. So Europe will have to do better in terms of managing its affairs on immigration, in order for the public to give governments the license to do the smarter things on immigration that it knows, everybody knows it has to do. Mm-hmm. And that will happen, you know, I may take 5, may take 10 years, but it will also happen. I'm sorry.
If I may just add a word to this, because it's a sincere criticism. Just with one word, I would say that the structure we have today, they are overpassed a long time ago. It's very difficult, as you pointed out, for one country to formulate new policies, let alone 28 member states and counting. The challenge is great, but we'll have to restructure, and we're on the way. I don't know if we started already anyway.
No, this is very true. And let me just, before I take a second round of questions, the holy grail of all of this is that we need to move. And that gets to your question about the Nomad, which you can explain later on, what that is, say, you know, a platform that the World Bank has that tries to, you know, sort of collect and analyze all of the evidence about different aspects of immigration. Is the Holy Grail is legal migration, orderly migration, safe migration. If we begin to approach those things, we'll do much better than we're doing today. And the public will actually acknowledge that.
You left out immigration.
And of course, I always get beat up about this.
You're just the kind of person we try to convince.
You got to do. So we'll take any questions there are, including your. But I want
can
to
you
give.
Explain, this is a Swiss model. Hmm? Your is the Swiss model.
The Swiss model.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Switzerland tries to do that. Yeah, I don't know that I call it any kind of a model. Any other questions? So, yes, one question back there.
Thank you. My name is Victoria Rittig. I work here at the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you very much for your presentations. As a German who spent most of her adult life in the U.S., today's topic is not just important for me professionally, but actually close to heart and, as you said, quite emotional. So I was wondering whether you could comment on a trend that I've been observing in the last, let's say, 8 to 10 years, which is there's two parallel trends. One I observe at panels such as this here or in New York, where you usually have a European representative and a U.S. representative, and both emphasize it's a good partnership, we are cooperating, we have our shared values, etc. And then there's the other trend that we see every day in our media, where you see an increased disillusionment with the partnership, and the Europeans saying, stop tapping our phones, and the Americans saying, start getting your house in order and stepping up. So I'm wondering, based on your experience with transatlantic dialogue on migration, can you speak about concrete examples where conversations about migration have happened, where conversations have happened about actual learning, lessons learned that can happen from one country to the other, and where that has actually fed into policy changes? Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Okay, this will be...
Edward Schumacher Matos, I'm a non-resident fellow here. For Michael, what would the countries, and I don't know if this comes up in your study with Penn and Temple, what would the country statistics look like for inequality if we didn't have that large pool of undocumented immigrants?
So these are going to be the last questions. You can answer these questions and also make a final statement, and we'll try to close in the next 3 or 4 minutes. But this was the direct question.
A couple examples, I guess, from talking to Europe about these issues. One that I mentioned, I referenced earlier, was in preparing for the high-level dialogue that took place very beginning of October last year. There was a sense that it could have sort of dissolved into a really ugly sort of south versus north, north versus south, a lot of blame shifting and lack of, sense of hopelessness kind of on these issues. And instead, there were some really positive discussions and looking for ways forward. And one of the steps that had been taken was a Australia-US-led workshop on international migration in advance. And one of the things that happened around that time was an effort was made to put down a list of things that we could agree on. And our folks were so impressed by that that we took a stab at a short list that we could put on our website. I think it's still there, that we could get interagency agreement on from the U.S. On things that were non-controversial and rallying points, so a more constructive approach rather than just fending off accusations. And when you tried to do that, we got much further along than we would have anticipated if we'd not had this good transatlantic example on which to build. More important right now for me is the discussions I'm having in Brussels and when folks visit here on this migrants and countries in crisis, because of commissioners, I've talked about it to commissioners of the European Union, and I'm used to talking to Kristalina Georgieva, who's the Bulgarian leader on humanitarian issues, but I've gotten to know and spoken quite a bit to Cecilia Malmström, who is the Home Affairs leader, and trying to talk to both of them then about this issue that I'm working on. And they also say DEVCO has a role to play too. So it really, again, it's a cross-cutting issue. There's more than one office involved, but there's certainly goodwill at every stop I'm making over there. At that level, there's a sense that we can work together and we can come up with examples that benefit each other. So I'm determined to keep trying. Now, I realize that second example is sort of half-baked in terms of, you were looking for things that are accomplished. And this one, I'm not there yet. But stay tuned. I'll come back. We'll talk about it again.
Thank you, Anne. Michael?
Edward, can I loudly pronounce that I really don't think I know? Face it, we're talking about half of we're talking about a fairly small share of jobs. You know, we're talking about a fairly small share of workers. And so there would be changes on the margin. But whether it would be the wholesale changes that people would argue for politically, that I'm dubious.
And of course, does it not also depend on the, you know, what it is that immigrants bring with them, how selected they are, et cetera, et cetera? If you keep increasing the low wage labor markets, you know, clearly you will create more of a gap.
Right.
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 Mr. Ambassador, you'd like
just
to say
if you
something?
Allow me okay. to close with this, that after the discussion, I'm convinced that the migration problems are going to be solved during our presidency, no matter how much we try. But on the other hand, let me say also that we draw some conclusions. Migration is a global phenomenon. It could be promising. Just you pointed out that we need a flow of workers, of new staff, especially in areas like Europe. But on the other hand, countries under stress right now, like mine, and we go through that every day, we understand very well the political constraint, which is not negligible. Suffice to say that some very extreme political movements, they take from this and in a populist way, they attract more and more people, and migration has to do something with this. It's not the only cause, of course. So we have to join forces indeed. We're doing that. There are no easy solutions, but both sides of the Atlantic, I believe that they're determined, I mean, to put more effort on this. Thank you very much for hosting us.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, Madam Assistant Secretary, Mr. CEO, all of you and those who are watching us. Thank you very much, and thank you for your patience. We started a little late, so we ended up a little late. And we hope to see you back on the 27th to discuss unaccompanied minors. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you. For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.